This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. 51 years ago, Gordon Moore, the co-founder of Intel, made a bold prediction. He predicted that the computing power of computer chips, the number of transistors you could fit on a piece of silicon, would double every 2 years. In other words, advances in miniaturization would move very quickly at an exponential rate. His prediction struck such a nerve that it became known as Moore's Law. And yes, we're still talking about it decades later. But today we find ourselves in a bit of a conundrum. Chipmakers have done such a good job of miniaturizing technology that Moore's Law has hit a headwind, because there's only so much smaller we can get before quantum hell breaks loose and the physics of these systems break down. So my next guest decided, instead of miniaturizing, how about starting with the very smallest component possible and working your way back? Start with the atom. He and his team succeeded in building a data storage device that uses individual atoms for bits. Sander Oda is an experimental physicist at the Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands. His research is in this week's issue of Nature Nanotechnology. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Tell us about what you built. You started with individual atoms, and how did you build it? How does it work?
Right. So let's compare it to an ordinary hard disk. So on an ordinary hard disk, you store bits. Those are information bits that can be either zero or one. And those are basically chunks of magnetic material on a disk that can magnetize either with their north pole one way or the other way. And that's the zero or the one. But each of those bits still contains thousands or ten thousands of atoms. So if you want to increase the capacity of such a disk, you would have to make those bits much smaller, right? Now, we did exactly the same thing as that, except that we stored the bits in individual atoms. So you should compare it. You should see this follows. We have a crystal surface on which we have a perfect grid of chlorine atoms. It's a square grid. So it's perfectly smooth. However, there are some atoms missing from the grid, so they look like holes. And then just like in a sliding puzzle where one piece is missing, you can slide a piece that's adjacent to a hole towards the hole, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how we stored the zeros and the ones. So on every site on that grid, there is either an atom or not. So it's perfectly digital, and that's how we stored the zeros and the ones.
Mm-hmm. And you have to do this at a very cold temperature, right?
That's correct. Cryogenic. Yeah. So as a physicist, we gauge how stable a material is by how warm you can make it before the atoms start to move by themselves. Because if you heat something up, the atoms essentially start to move by themselves. And at some point, that becomes so much that you lose the data. It becomes scrambled by that.
Now, this is not to be confused with a quantum computer, correct?
That's a very good point. Yes, this is a classical storage of information. So each bit is either one or zero. And in a quantum bit, it can be a combination of one and zero. That's not the case here.
So, but you're working on the quantum level. Doesn't quantum stuff sneak in at that level?
Well, that's a very good question. So, if you look at these atoms, so if you think about what makes something quantum, right? In order for something to be quantum, it should be well isolated from its environment. So, as soon as the environment kind of probes a quantum object, it forces it to choose either of the two states that it can be in. So it loses its quantum nature by interacting with the environment. Now, these atoms that are in this surface, they are very tightly bound to their neighbors and to the substrate. So they're really very well in contact with their vicinity, and therefore they can absolutely not retain any quantum uncertainty for any serious amount of time. So it's really a classical bit of information.
Hmm. So you're not worried about sneaking in, you know, getting to some level where you're going to be dealing with these quantum weirdness things.
I'm not sure worried is the right word. I would love to see quantum effects. Actually, my background research is in precisely these kind of quantum effects. So this whole research on the kilobyte that we now made, this memory storage, is kind of a sidestep for me. Normally, what I'm interested in is to explore the transition from quantum effects to classical physics. So if you think about it, a single magnetic atom, for example, an iron atom, is a quantum object. So it can have a superposition of having its magnetization pointing one way and the other. We call that a superposition of spin up and spin down. Now, if you put a second iron atom adjacent to it and they couple together, they are still a quantum object. They're, for example, up, up, or down, down, or up, down, and down, up. It's still quantum because they can be both at the same time. But if you add more atoms to it, at some point, the atoms collectively decide to form a classical system. So at some point, and this is a gradual process, at some point they collectively decide, hey, let's just force ourselves to point one way and be a classical thing. And exactly that transition is something that fascinates me a lot and I've been studying in recent years.
Mm-hmm. So when do we get a practical, what do you call this computer? A micro, what's the term you're using?
I call it a memory. It's really a storage device. So it's not a, it doesn't compute. It's not a...
Right.
It's not a transistor, right? A transistor would have to have an input, an output, and a gate, so that has a certain functionality. Here, it's just a storage of information.
So you have a three-dimensional, like a crystalline structure with the atoms and all the different parts of the crystal?
Well, actually, we only use the surface of a crystal. So yes, the crystal itself is a three-dimensional object, but then we cut that crystal at a perfectly flat edge. And then and that's actually a copper crystal. So it's copper atoms that we start with. And on top of this copper crystal, we deposit in vacuum a layer of chlorine atoms. And these chlorine atoms, they form together with the copper a salt. So it's an ionic bond. And that turns out to have very nice properties for this kind of data storage. It's a very reliable self-terminating coverage of chlorine atoms.
And how much data can you store? What is the potential for this?
Right, so we went up to a kilobyte, which is a lot compared to previous attempts. So let's take a few steps back. So the first time that atoms were moved was back in the early 1990s by a team at IBM, and then they wrote this iconic picture, the letters IBM of 35 xenon atoms. That was a tremendous achievement for that time. Now, in the quarter century that followed, the technique didn't change that much. It was all the time. It was just a very manual, painstakingly slow labor to put all these atoms where you want it. And so you could at most get a handful of atoms in place. Now, what we figured out now is with this particular surface and with the particular techniques we're using, with these holes rather than the atoms, that we basically have the atomic scale printing press. So all of a sudden we can scale this up to thousands of atoms, even 10,000s of atoms. And that's how we stored a kilobyte. So a kilobyte is 1,000 bytes and a byte is 8 bits. So these are 8,000 bits.
Okay.
However, I think that there is no physical limitation that would disable us from going much bigger than this still.
So you could make in a tiny little space, you can store the equivalent of many volumes of books or whatever you're storing.
Right. So one estimation we made is that if you would scale this up still two dimensionally to the size of a post stamp, the area of a postage stamp, that would be enough surface to keep all the books ever written by mankind written out. However, that is of course kind of a silly comparison because we are never actually gonna make this to a postage stamp size. At least I don't think so that we're gonna do this at short time. But it just shows you how tremendously small all this is and what the capabilities of this technology can be.
So what is, if you're not gonna go in that direction, what direction do you want to take this, and what is the reason for constructing this?
Yes. So, to be very honest, the data storage is, of course, an example that we made because it's something people can relate to, and it's a beautiful image, and it's a story that's easy to tell. But to me personally, as a scientist, as a physicist, there's a much deeper message here, which is that for the first time in history, we are able to construct objects at a scale that was just inaccessible before. If you look at the scan that we made of that full kilobyte, you see that we created order in a chaos at a level that we never were able to create order in chaos. And I think this really opens the door to all kinds of experiments and also technologies that involve playing with the positions of the atoms in the material. And in the end, that is also what determines how a material behaves. So all the properties that a material has on the macroscopic scale find their origin in how the atoms interact. And once we can start to play with that on a scale that we now did and with a level of reliability that we now did, I think there is a tremendous world of possibilities.
Think out loud with me. What would you do now to add to that? How would you play with your...
Right. So there's a saying among physicists that more is different. So more is different means that even if you would know the exact laws of quantum physics, that tell you how atoms behave, you still wouldn't be able to predict exactly how materials would behave if you would have thousands of these atoms. The reason for this is that the number of constituents, the number of levels of freedom, degrees of freedom, is so huge that even the smartest people in the world that have access to the best computers in the world would not be able to predict what's going to happen. So at the scale of 1,000 or 10,000 atoms, all kinds of properties emerge that you cannot predict out of quantum mechanics. And these phenomena that you study, they kind of require their own language, their own pictures. It's really a field of itself, a field of study of itself, where we can learn a lot.
But you don't know yourself where it's going to end up or what you might come up with.
Certainly not. I can give some examples, though, right? So a nice example is superconductivity. Superconductivity is an effect that happens in some materials when you cool them down to very low temperatures. And that is intrinsically a quantum effect. So it's one of these quantum effects that do not die out even though you go to larger scale. They just retain their quantum nature. And in superconductivity, a material basically loses all its electrical resistivity. So it's a very useful idea. Now, we know to some extent how this arises, but in many materials, we actually don't know how it comes about. So if we can start to play and build basically materials ourselves rather than be limited to the materials that nature provides us, but you start to build the materials yourself, you choose yourself which atom goes where, you might learn about the emergence of these kind of phenomena like superconductivity. I'm not saying necessarily superconductivity, of course, but that kind of stuff is what becomes available when you start to tinker with the material on the atomic scale.
Dr. Oda, very fascinating. And we wish you great luck, and you'll come back on and tell us when you get your next step, okay?
Thank you, I will.
Sander Oda is an experimental physicist at the Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands. We're going to take a break when we come back, and we're going to talk about, you know, the bubbles that people live in where politics are concerned. But what happens when you live outside the bubble among people that you disagree with? We discuss some new and interesting research. It's all happening after the break, so come on back. We'll see you after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We turn now to politics, a subject that, like religion, you're supposed to avoid in polite company, especially in this politically charged year. But according to research conducted over the past few years, you're actually not as likely as you once were to be in the kind of mixed company where politics talk might be contentious. What I mean to say is that Americans are increasingly living in bubbles. Since the 1980s or so, we've been sorting ourselves geographically into like-minded communities of red and blue politics. And as the Republican Convention gives way to the Democratic Convention next week, we wanted to explore the effects of these bubbles. What effects do they have on us, and how we might reverse the polarization trend? First, new research from out of the University of Illinois Chicago and Michigan State tells us more about the people who don't live in bubbles, but rather are surrounded by people they disagree with. And it turns out that living in discord with your neighbors can hurt your ability to befriend anyone, even the politically like-minded. We want to hear from you. Are you politically isolated, the only Trump voter in Democratic country, or the only progressive in a conservative area? Our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, or you can tweet us at SciFry. My guest is Matt Motel, assistant professor of psychology at the University of Illinois Chicago. He's also on the board of directors of civilpolitics.org. Dr. Motel, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Nice to be here.
Yeah, nice for you to join us. Your latest research looks at not the people in the bubble, but the people who are living outside of their political bubbles. How does this kind of isolation affect our well-being?
Well, in general, when we're encountering people that think that our beliefs are evil or crazy or wrong, it's pretty stressful. So when we're surrounded by these people, we feel uncomfortable, we feel like we don't belong, and this can have a lot of negative health consequences. So our mental and physical health can suffer when we're surrounded by these people that kind of think we're wrong or crazy. And by contrast, when we're surrounded by people that agree with us, there are lots of positive consequences. So we're happier, we're healthier, and we're less stressed out because, well, you're not walking on eggshells anytime you express what your important values are.
So how are politics, are politics so important that they drive such a basic social function, our ability to connect and to rely on others?
In the last few decades, politics has become much more than just politics. It's not whether you vote for one party or another. It's also what church you go to, or if you go to a church. It is the types of sports you like. It's the type of places that you shop. It includes a whole lot more of your social life than just how you vote come November.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean that that people are moving to places, that locations where they're more likely to fit in politically?
Indeed. People are moving increasingly into red or blue communities, and this is something that's really picked up over the last 30 or 40 years. And the majority of Americans in the 1970s lived in competitive districts where it could go either toward the Democrat or the Republican. But now about 70 to 80% of Americans, they live in these landslide districts where their party is winning by more than 20 percentage points over the other party. And when that happens, you're much less likely to encounter people that don't share your political beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Do we have evidence that the dislike of others as opposed to preference for the politically similar is growing?
So the political prejudice is increasing dramatically right now. And there's this phenomenon called affective polarization, where you like your party more than the other party. And this is something that's increased dramatically over time, where as in the past, we liked our party more than the other party. But now we actively dislike the other party and have very negative attitudes towards them. So this is something that's increased over that same time period as we've seen this rising ideological segregation.
Well, so if people feel isolated or upset, it makes them a little, you know, their life not comfortable if they're outside of their bubble. I mean, you would not recommend them staying there, would you?
Right. I mean, it satisfies a basic personal psychological need to belong. So that's why we argue that people are more likely to migrate when they're surrounded by people that disagree with them.
Is there anything you can do if you want to, try to deal with people who don't believe like you do? Is there any way to bring them over to have a civil discussion?
Well, I think part of it is trying to have an open mind about who you're talking to and not assuming that the other side is that their attitudes are completely baseless or that they're rooted in some sort of immorality, which is what a lot of people do when they're thinking about the other side. They say, oh, well, they must be racist or they must be something really negative if they're going to believe that, rather than, oh, maybe they have some kind of concrete reason or some reasonable justification for their belief.
Yeah, I want to bring in two more guests whose work relates to this conversation. Liz Joyner is director of the Village Square in Tallahassee, and Rob Willer is a professor of sociology and psychology at Stanford University. Welcome, Dr. Willer. Liz Joyner.
Pleasure
to join you.
Thanks for having
me.
Liz, tell us what does the Village Square try to do about this?
Well, so as Matt described, really the ebb and flow of daily life used to create opportunities for us to have some sort of relationship with people who had views different than ours. But these days it really doesn't. We're using social media and technology to spend lots of time with people just like us. So that's not going to change because it's part of human nature. But it means that building community across a vision really just has to be something that we're intentional about now. And that's the work of the Village Square. We have a number of events every year where our goal isn't to solve a policy problem, write a white paper, or host a debate. It's really about building relationships, creating empathy, and civic glue between different silos of people inside of a hometown.
Mm-hmm. So you're not really setting out to change people's minds on issues. I mean, it's very hard to change anybody's mind, is it?
I think our goal is that you have to go in first through the relationship door. It's way easier to get there. Human beings have an amazing power of sort of reciprocal good to people that they know and they meet and they talk to and they break bread with. And so that's where you have to start. And if you can solve, issues later, it has to start with that relationship first.
You know, one of the reasons for Washington discord I've heard people talk about who live in Washington is that in the old days, all the congressmen and senators actually lived among each other and would go, even though they didn't agree with one another, their families would meet and they maybe sit down to dinner or lunch or whatever. But now they all live at home. They go home on weekends. The people don't spend time with each other. They don't get to know the opposition very well. It's just never, there is no interaction. It's sort of saying, what you're saying is that at least get people to sit down and talk with one another and see that they're real human beings.
That's right. And it sounds really simple. It sounds like a little thing. And the truth is, if we grasp the fact that that really is what this is all about, then it becomes a matter of changing habits, of just realizing when you spend a lot of time with people who are just like you, frankly, you're in a bubble, you're in a silo. And that's what creates a lot of the kind of division and anger that we're seeing now. It's actually easier to solve than it seems at first. If you just walk out your door and look for people who are different than you, have a conversation.
Rob Willer, you've done work looking at the language we use when we try to convince people to agree with us. What makes it so hard to communicate across ideological divides?
Well, that is the takeaway, is it is so hard. And, you know, what we find is that liberals and conservatives, when they go to persuade one another on some political issue, they tend to make arguments in terms of their own moral values. And in effect, they reach out and try to persuade one another as though they were looking into a mirror, making the arguments that they themselves find persuasive. But this neglects the fact that in the United States, liberals and conservatives tend to care about really different things. They tend to hold different moral values. Liberals care a lot about equality, fairness, protecting vulnerable people from harm. Where conservatives care a lot about group loyalty, patriotism, moral purity, religious sanctity. And so, you know, one way to think about this is that our divided political map is undergirded by a very divided moral map as well.
So is there no common ground, anything that I'm looking at the Venn diagram in my mind where we overlap that might start a discussion that people
agree? Yeah, I think there is some overlap for sure. I mean, it'd be easy to exaggerate how divided we are. I think there is a little bit of common ground. But what we've sought as a rhetorical technique, a path to persuasion, is to sort of acknowledge the difference, that this idea that underneath the political gulf, there's a big moral gulf, and try to use it strategically in a persuasion, you know, opportunity. So when you're interacting with somebody who's got really different politics from you and you infer really different morals from you, can you find some way to draw a connection between your political view that you're trying to communicate to them and their moral values rather than your own? A way that they could come to agree with you without forsaking their values.
Our number, if you'd like to get in on our conversation, 844-724-8255 is what we're talking about here today. It's the political and social divide. When people sit down, and have you been successful with this? Have you gotten people to sit down and look at each other and speak to each other and become productive?
Yeah, we've had really good success, actually, usually in testing arguments that we construct and then directing people to construct arguments in experiments.
Give me an example of how you would do this. Give me what goes on in a meeting.
Absolutely. So for example, we constructed an argument in support of same-sex marriage in terms of patriotism and group loyalty, an argument that gay Americans are loyal, proud Americans who contribute to our military and economy and deserve the rights that our country grants to all its citizens. And we found that this sort of patriotism-based message was significantly more effective than a conventional argument in terms of equality in swaying conservatives to support same-sex marriage. And, you know, we found that this technique worked for liberals as well. We found if you want to sell liberals on high levels of military spending, it works better if you argue that the military is an engine for promoting social mobility, a domain in society where minorities and the poor can compete on a level playing field. So, you know, this is a technique that seems to work either way.
Interesting. You just have to be creative about how you do this. I would imagine. Can you talk sports? Or is that out of bounds also?
I mean, obviously finding any basis of common ground, any way to break up that affective divide is a great idea. But yeah, we find that bringing respect and empathy to political discourse goes a long way. And it starts, in our research anyway, with saying, okay, this is what I believe this person's moral values probably are. How might they agree with me on this political position? Because values are deeply rooted. People will fight and die for their values. And it's going to be hard to move people on that.
Let me go to the phones. Jackie in Delafield, Wisconsin. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh my gosh, thank you for the topic. You just pitched this one right into my wheelhouse. I live in Waukesha, Wisconsin, which is an extremely conservative part of the world. It's also a very beautiful part of the world, and I moved there as a lifelong fourth-generation registered Democrat to get my daughter in good schools, which has worked wonderfully. She's in graduate school now, but my point is that I found common ground with my very conservative neighbors under the idea of trees and tree protection. I am also have been managed to be elected. I'm a city council representative. If the election were not nonpartisan and my wonderful neighbors who reelect me time and again knew that I was a registered Democrat, I'm not sure they would vote for me, or maybe they would now. But it's quite interesting. You have to find common ground, and it's actually, I think it's important that we not live only by like-minded people. It's kind of lonely. I often reference myself as a pioneer liberal.
All right. That's an interesting story. Let me get a reaction. But first, let me remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatto, talking with Rob Willer, Liz Joyner, and Matt Motel. Anybody want to talk about that? She has kept secret that she's a registered Democrat and gotten elected as a local politician.
Well, obviously, the anger has made it much harder to cross divides today. But one of the things that we've found is it's almost like you don't even have to have a really substantial common interest. It can be something that is just superficial. So, for example, really, in everything we do, we're working on creating cross-cutting relationships with between people who disagree. And you can disagree completely on politics, but maybe your kids play softball together. Just that really is a humanizing force. It lets you see people as being complex as we are, and that changes everything.
Liz, you call your work both mandatory and impossible. Why is it both?
It's taken decades for us to get where we are, and we're all pretty clear that it's not a good place. Frankly, it's going to take decades to get us out, but we have to start. There is actually no choice but to start working to turn it around. And we're really excited about the general field that Matt and Rob are in, because we think that they're leading the direction out. And so we are following closely behind in their learnings regarding how you do it. One of the things that we think is so important that actually Jackie was describing is that the vast majority of this work is really going to have to be done in communities where people operate as parts of a social system together, because that's where you can build the relationships and that's where you can transcend the labels and the silos.
It's one by one finding like-minded people who want to work this out, maybe. Find a way like you do.
Yeah, I mean, we're out there everywhere.
Matt Motel, any comment? How do you get people to? How do you search for people who are like-minded or want to do this and maybe get in a group together to discuss this?
It's tricky, and I think that there are a lot of great community organizations, just like Liz's, the Village Square, that tries to find these people and bring them together. Because as we live in these ideological enclaves, it's becoming harder and harder to find people that disagree with you politically.
So not bring up the topic when you meet them?
That's what people have been telling me for years over Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah, politics and religion. Just don't bring it up at the poker game and you'll be able to get through it. I want to thank all of my guests for joining me. This has been a great discussion. Matt Motel is assistant professor of psychology, University of Illinois, Chicago. Dr. Rob Wheeler is professor of sociology and psychology at Stanford University. Liz Joyner, director of the Village Square in Tallahassee. Liz, how can they find you on the web?
We actually have a few Village Square tools you can use from anywhere. Check out bookclubonrace.com, jeffersondinner.org. And if you want to see our home page, it is tothevillagesquare.org.
All right. We're going to take a break. And coming up, we're going to hear about the shocking behavior, I'm sorry to say, of electric eels. Why do they send out those shocks? And it's not just for capturing the prey. It's a very interesting video pick this week. Coming up, stay with us. We'll be right back after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Electric eels, as their name suggests, are known for giving out powerful shocks. A 6-foot eel can put out 600 volts. That's about 5 times the amount of electricity coming from your wall socket at home. Wow. But these eels are more than just a taser with a tail. The amount of volts an eel puts out is based on its surroundings. Emily Driscoll visited the lab of a researcher who is trying to figure out these shocking behaviors, and it's the subject of our latest video. Emily Driscoll is a science documentary producer based here in New York. Always good to see you, Emily.
Great to be here.
Eels use these shocks when they're hunting for food or against a predator, but there's a certain behavior that this researcher is looking into. Tell us about that.
Yes. Ken Catania at Vanderbilt, he's been studying eels for a couple of years now, and he's looking at their behavior and how they use electricity. And eels, they can send out short pulses of electricity to sense their environment and see what prey is there. They can launch high volleys of electricity to paralyze their prey and eat them. But Ken Catania, he found this new behavior kind of on accident. He was moving one of his larger eels, a 3-foot eel, from one tank to another, and he was using a net with a handle. And as he put the handle in the water, the eel turned around and started aggressively going towards him and trying to leap up the net in his handle. Out of the water. So he made a note, I need to study this. Because he had never seen that kind of behavior before.
And so is there precedent for that?
There actually is.
The eel's leaping out of the water?
There actually is. So Alexander von Humboldt in 1800, he is a very famous German naturalist explorer and scientist, and he went on expeditions around the world, and he went to the Amazon because he wanted to collect some electric eels, and he hadn't had success collecting them before, so he got some local fishermen to help him, and they said that they would fish with horses. So they rounded up about 30 horses, and they went into a muddy pool, and all of this horses in activity and kicking up all this mud, it scared the eels. And the eels acted out very aggressively and ended up coming up, and there was a 5-foot eel there. The eel rose up, pressed its head against the belly of the horse, and shocked it.
Wow.
So, yeah, this
scared the horse. Did it kill the horse?
So this was a really major spectacle going on between these 30 horses and all these eels. And it ended up killing a couple of horses, probably stunning them, and then they drowned. But it was an incredible spectacle, and then the eels were exhausted, so he was able to collect the eels. But even then, Humboldt wrote about this in 1807, and even in 1807, people didn't believe the account.
And so the scientist you were working with found that account, and he found a record of that.
Exactly. So, and he decided to test this, and he used some kind of unique props to do it.
Tell us what they were.
Well, yeah. It was kind of interesting to be in his lab and see all of his scientific equipment. He wanted to put something that would be a predator, and so he used a crocodile head.
A real crocodile.
It was a fake crocodile head, but something that would be a stand-in for a predator. And then he put it in the water, and he filmed it, and he also put LEDs on the crocodiles, and they would light up when there's electricity given off by the eel. And he recorded it, and he saw how the eel rose up and pressed itself against the crocodile, and it's very dramatic footage because of the LED lights, the lights going off, and also the slow motion. You can really see how the eel climbs up.
Now, we have audio of what the shock sounded like through your speaker, so let's hear a little bit of that. Wow. Were you scared at all? when you were filming?
Well, one thing I was afraid about, I got to use the special Science Friday GoPro camera, and we weren't sure how that would, if that would survive 600 volts of electricity. So we put that in the tank with the eel, and it actually was just fine, fantastic. And we really got some exciting footage showing how the eels eat, because everything happens so quickly, you can barely see it. So you're right in there in the tank with the eel, and we also filmed it in slow motion.
And the camera survived okay.
It did.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow. As always, Emily, an excellent, excellent video. This is a fun one to look at, and I'm sure it wasn't that fun when Emily was worried about getting shocked there. Emily Driscoll, science documentary producer based here in New York. Thanks for joining us. And you can see her video. It's a great one, as I say, at sciencefriday.com/eels. This week marks the 47th anniversary of the first landing on the moon and the tense last few moments to the surface. As you can hear in this exchange between Neil Armstrong and Mission Control, the team received an unexpected 1201 alarm from the Eagle's computer.
Roger, understand. Go for landing. 3,000 feet. Stop alarm. 1201. Roger, 1201 alarm. We're go, same type, we're go.
Wow. In that dramatic last few seconds, Neil Armstrong guided his lander to the surface of the moon. And while Neil's skills as a pilot helped safely navigate the final last few feet of the descent, if it weren't for the remarkable skills of a group of women coders working behind the scenes at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, we might never have heard Neil Armstrong say those famous one small step for a man line on the moon. Joining me to talk about these women is my guest, Nathalia Holt. She's author of the new book, Rise of the Rocket Girls, the women who propelled us from missiles to the moon to Mars. Nathalia, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much.
Now, we heard in the audio there was a mention of 1201 alarm. What was happening there?
This is happening just 3 minutes before the Eagle is going to land. And Buzz Aldrin, who is following his checklist, turns on the rendezvous radar. And when this happens, the CPU on the computer just becomes overloaded. It's important to remember here how little memory this computer had compared to the systems we have today. Our cell phones have millions of times more memory than this computer did. And so the alarm goes off because the computer is just having trouble doing so many different functions. And when the astronauts hear this alarm, they don't know what a 1201 or a 1202 alarm refers to. And so they and Mission Control have to make a very difficult decision. Are they going to abort, or are they going to trust the software to get them through this? And listening to all of this at MIT is a woman named Margaret Hamilton. And she's responsible for the Apollo onboard flight software. She's director of the software engineering division at MIT's instrumentation lab. And it is actually her code that saves the day. It's able to override all of the other functions and make landing the priority.
But Neil has to take over manual control and land it, correct?
It's still the software that has to ultimately do the landing. So it's doing it together, man and machine, working as one to land the Eagle.
In your book, you talk about a group of women coders who worked at JPL on a lot of NASA projects. How did they get to be all women?
They were women because of a very special person named Macy Roberts. She was made supervisor of this unique group in 1942 at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And they were known as computers. So before all of the devices we have today, it was humans that were actually hired to do the calculations for laboratories. And so Macy Roberts decided that she wanted to make it an all-female group because she worried that if she hired a man, they just wouldn't listen to her because she was a female.
So she just hired women.
Yes.
And one of these women was Susan Finley, and she worked on something called the Deep Space Network, right?
Yes, that's right. Sue Finley has such a long history at NASA. She is still working there today. She's actually NASA's longest serving female employee. And she worked on the earliest spacecraft to the moon, the Ranger series and the Surveyor spacecraft, as well as building the Deep Space Network.
Is it true that she was demoted in her position at NASA because she doesn't have a degree?
Yes, she was. This happened in 2008, and she unfortunately was demoted to a technical position. But she loves her job there. She is very happy with her work. She's had a very long career there.
I can't believe it. I mean, she's worked for decades, but well, that's NASA's policy, I guess.
Maybe someone
at NASA listening now might reconsider that.
I hope so.
were you surprised when you discovered that the story of this group of women hadn't been told really yet?
I was, because they had such a critical role, and especially in these early lunar missions, I think we forget how many failures it took to actually get to the moon. We had 6 failures of these Ranger spacecraft before we finally were able to land a spacecraft on the moon. And it was the work of these women. They were in mission control. They were plotting the trajectories. They were a critical part of making this happen.
And if it weren't for these women and the network, we wouldn't have heard Neil Armstrong's famous words, right?
That's right. We needed this network of large parabolic antenna in order to be able to receive the signal from space. And we still use that network today for all of our communication.
Let's talk about how the men viewed these women. Many, if not most of these women, had long careers at NASA and JPL. Do you think that despite the fact that we've heard very little about them over the years, that they felt respected by their male colleagues there?
They did. They had wonderful relationships with their male colleagues, even though for a long time they were paid less and were in a position of computer instead of being called engineers. But despite that, they had these wonderful working relationships with the men, and they really loved their careers at NASA. I think we can be very proud that NASA was hiring women at such an early time, from the 1940s and 50s, to play this key role in space exploration.
And are the women still active, as active as they were before, in now the current space missions?
Well, we have a very exciting thing that's happened this year, where half of the 2016 astronaut class is women. So women today are very important, of course, at NASA. But still, we can do more. Only 23% of scientists and engineers in our space agency are women. So that's an area where I think we can help inspire and hopefully get more women to join the space program.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 844-724-8255. If you'd like to talk to Nathalia Holt on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. What kind of a response have you received from your book? People happy to hear about these women?
Well, I've noticed from young people especially, they find these stories very inspiring. It's wonderful to know that women were such an essential part of our space program from the very beginning. And of course, for me, the most rewarding part is being able to see the women themselves finally have the recognition they deserve after so many decades.
Why do you think it is? And it seems different from other businesses, you know. Why women geeks, geeky programming ladies, are accepted by geeky programming men as equals and not outside?
Yes, well, it used to be, of course, that women were the ones that did most of the computer programming. And unfortunately, that trend has dropped. We see such a decline in the number of women getting degrees in computer programming today. And so it's important that we make sure we make opportunities available for women to go into these fields.
Do you think that, they talk about coding as another language, and people are suggesting, hey, you know, if you take French or Spanish, why not take a computer coding as a language instead? Would you think that's a good idea for women to do in high school?
Absolutely. And what's great is that we already have some wonderful programs that help encourage women to learn programming early on. There's Girls Who Code and other wonderful programs that help women learn about languages and learn about computers from a very early age, hopefully even before high school.
Is Susan Finley still active?
She is. She is still at the lab. She was a very critical player in Juno, so our mission to Jupiter. And so she was the one who was able to tell us when that mission was really a success and when the spacecraft went into orbital insertion around the planet.
So does she talk about retirement? You say that she is the longest-serving person at NASA.
She has no plans of retiring currently. She really loves her work. She's been there for 58 years, and she's just been a part of about every NASA mission you can think of.
All right, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Barbara, and she's at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, one of our favorite places. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say thank you for writing the book. I was given the book by a colleague here at NASA, and he said when he heard this book was being released, he said he had to buy it for Barbara. And it was especially wonderful to me that two of your main characters in the book are two of the main women are named Barbara, so that was pretty special to me. And I've actually had the chance to exchange emails briefly with Susan Finley.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, so I came late to NASA in my career. I'm mid-50s now. I've worked in industry for a long time, but I do find that women are extremely respected at NASA, and so are older workers. There's not as much ageism and sexism here as I find in industry in general.
But that is wonderful to hear.
Yeah, I want to say thank you for writing the book. It really touched my heart.
Barbara, can I ask what you do there at Marshall?
I'm a quality engineer.
What does that mean?
Well, my background is in chemical engineering. I've worked in manufacturing for 25 years, and I spend my time in the Safety Mission Assurance Directorate, making mm-hmm. sure that all the requirements can be verified, all the hardware is designed and built correctly, that when the hardware is built, it's going to work as expected and be safe.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say you came to this late in life. Were you somebody with a pocket protector early on, or?
Oh, I was a Trekkie from the time it came out. and actually, most of the people that work at NASA are lifelong geeks.
Yeah,
use the right word. It's a great place to be.
Yeah, we're trying to change the word to Benji because we think Benjamin Franklin is more appropriate to being a being a science person and an arts person. You know, that's how a lot of people are these days, right?
Oh, especially in Huntsville, the same parts of the brain do a lot of these things. It's a wonderful place to be.
So they're more Benji. Thank you very much for calling, Barbara.
In fact, lots of musicians in the safety and mission assurance world here.
give our regards to everybody there. Have a great weekend. That was and thank you too for joining us, Nathalia, and good luck with your book. Great book.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Nathalia Holt, author of the new book, Rise of the Rocket Girls, The Women Who Propelled Us from Missiles to Moon to to Mars. Before we go, here's one for bird lovers, a new photo gallery on our website, breathing some life into the ornithology collection at the Royal Ontario Museum. So see exquisite close-ups of tree swallows. We got black sickle bills and bald eagle feathers. The photos are at sciencefriday.com/beautifulbirds. Speaking of beautiful, BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.